Averis B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
I'd like to dedicate this Shmooze Refuah Shleimah to my Rebbe, Al Tehenach Chanoch Ben Chai Rivka Leah, the Reshiva. Should be well. Every once in a while you come across a mitzvah in the Torah that doesn't seem to apply to us, that doesn't seem to be applicable to our lifestyle, the way we conduct ourselves. And then when you start learning it, you start realizing that there's a tremendous amount to be gained from it. One such mitzvah is a mitzvah losachros b'shor v'chamor yachdov. Do not plow with your donkey and your ox together. Again, in an agricultural society that had great relevance, you would assume that in our world, this has nothing to teach us. But there's a fascinating line that the Das HaKinim explains to us, the reason behind it. And when you see the reason behind it, I think there is a tremendous lesson. Says the Das HaKinim as follows, L'sachrosh b'shor v'chomer yachtov, why is it that you should not plow with your ox and your donkey together? L'fishashor malagera, because the shor, the ox, regurgitates. It's a ruminant. Typically, there are four stomachs in the cow. The cow regurgitates its cud, then chews it again, swallows it again, spits it back up, swallows again four times altogether. As a result, it's chewing all day. So because the shor is malageru mitzta'er hachamor, the donkey will have tsar, will have pain. Kishiyishma shor ochel, the two will plow together. The cow will be chewing all day. The donkey won't. The donkey eats and then is finished. So the donkey will hear the shor chewing all day. The donkey is going to have pain over the fact that it's not eating, but its teammate is. Therefore, says the Torah, do not join the two together because it's going to cause tsar to the donkey. Don't do it. Okay. Now, very interesting tam in the mitzvah. However, I'd like to share with you a very interesting observation. The Gemara in Chulin is very explicit and very specific as to how one is to shecht an animal. There are five different potential things that will postulate it. There's a particular place where you should shecht. There's a particular way how you should shecht. There's a particular way to do every nuance in it. But not only is it a specified part of the way a Jew should eat, nowhere in Kol HaTorah Kula do you see any inference that you shouldn't eat meat. Not only that, on the 14th of Nisan, every Jewish person, a Jewish male, is obligated, min HaTorah, to be involved in the Korban of the Korban Pesach. And if you don't, you chayev karis. So here's the question. Clearly, the Torah doesn't forbid us from eating meat. The Torah allows us to wear shoes. The Torah allows us to wear belts made out of leather. So how is that consistent with what the Torah seems to be saying over here? Have rachmonis, have mercy on the donkey. The poor donkey, look at him. He's going to be plowing together with the shor. He's going to have pain. Have mercy on him. If the Torah wanted to have mercy on animals, I would assume there'd be a lot better way to do that. And that would be to treat them as they do in Indian culture, to revere them, to put them on a pedestal, certainly not to use them as beasts of burden, certainly not to eat them. And it seems to be a rather problematic issue. How are we supposed to here treat the animal with sensitivity, and yet we're clearly told that it's permitted to eat this very animal? And I'd like to see if we can answer this Das HaKinim. And when we do this, I think we'll get a much better understanding of this whole concept of how the Torah views this issue. And let me begin with something that the Reshiva taught us many years ago. There is a Yerushalmi that's fascinating, because the Yerushalmi says, how does one work on the come up? Let's say you have a problem with revenge, you're angry at someone, and you want to take revenge, and there's nothing sweeter in the world than your desire, your drive to avenge the wrong that was done to you. That's a reality, that's human nature, but I don't want to do it. So the Gemara Yerushalmi gives us an Eitzah, gives us an advice. What is the advice to a person who feels he has to take vengeance? Says the Gemara as follows. Imagine that you're cutting a loaf of bread. You're holding the bread with your right hand, and you begin cutting it with your left hand. Your left hand slips and you cut your right hand. Would your right hand then take the knife? You stab me, I'll stab you back. That's ludicrous. It's the same body, two hands. If the left hand stabbed the right hand wouldn't grab the knife and then go stab the left hand. Says the Gemara in Yerushalmi, that is the Eitzah, that is the practical advice, how you should learn not to take revenge. Just understand there's one unit called the Klai Yisrael, and there's one unit called the Jewish nation. If you're going to avenge the wrong, you're taking your left hand, stabbing your right hand. It's foolish. And says the Gemara, this is the antidote for revenge. And the Shiva then asked the following question. And the question is that this does not sound like a very practical piece of advice. In theory, you tell me there's such a concept, well, one unit, the Jewish people, the Jewish nation, it's an interesting idea. I could buy into the concept, but we're talking about a man who's furious, a man who wants nothing more than vengeance, and a man who understands he shouldn't do it. How are you going to give him practical advice? Imagine left hand, right hand, it's theory. But it doesn't sound very practical. It sounds way, way highfalutin and sounds very difficult to relate to. And the Rishiva answered that question on the Yerushalmi, and I'd like to share with you the basic idea of what the Rishiva explained to us. But to do that, I'd like to take a very quick tour of modern psychology. Modern man owes a lot to Sigmund Freud. The discovery of the subconscious, the discovery of things going on beneath the surface of man's consciousness was something that he brought to the modern world. However, if you've read anything about Freud, you also realize that he was reasonably demented. And I use that word very guardedly. If you read his understanding of the human psyche, if you read how he envisioned what motivates, what drives a human, you get a very perverse, very awkward, demented view of the human. And I dare say, if you read it, you should say, gee golly, it doesn't describe me nor anyone else that I can relate to or know. And the reality is that while Sigmund Freud did bring certain concepts to the fore, he had a rather unusual view of mankind. Many years later, B.F. Skinner changed the world of psychology's view of man. He was known as the father of behaviorism. He began with a different pattern. He began studying different animals. He began studying the animal kingdom. And he studied their patterns of behavior, their ways of communicating, and he took that over to mankind. It wasn't until 1970 when Abraham Maslow published his first book that he effectively debunked both schools. And his first point that he says was as follows. If you're going to study crippled, stunted, immature, and unhealthy specimens, you're going to come up with a crippled psychology and a crippled philosophy. And his basic point was, the reason why Freud went so far off was because the segment of the population that he was studying were people with very real problems. He was not studying a healthy, significant portion of humankind. He was studying a very, very fragmented part of the universe who were very, very much troubled, who may in fact have exhibited thoughts and behaviors that influenced Sigmund Freud. But the reality is, when you study that and assume that's every man, you come out with a very distorted view of man. Skinner went a step beyond that, because what Skinner did was he took a more global view, but he also took the perspective of assuming that the animal kingdom and man are the same. Maslow was the first person who began studying a different group of people. He began studying large groups of very successful individuals, people from different walks of life, and he began identifying what are the motivating forces, what are the driving forces with the humans. And you probably remember from basic psychology that Maslow came up with this hierarchy of needs. And the way he segmented the human is as follows. At the base of the triangle, every human being has the basic needs for air, water, food. These are the physiological needs that every human being has. And the first thing that a human being is driven to fulfill is those basic physical needs. If you do not have food, clothing, shelter, your basic needs, you will not aspire for anything more. You won't go to anything higher. You will meet those needs. However, he says, once those basic needs are met, once you have your basic physical needs met, there's a natural instinct in man to go to the next level. The next level is what he calls safety needs. And what that means in his language is the need for safe families, safe borders, to feel protected within my world. Once those two basic needs are met, Maslow says there's an instinctive drive in the human for a feeling of love, belonging, and connection. Once the human's basic needs for air, water, the basic physiological needs are met, then he says every human being has a tremendous need to belong, to feel attached, and to be a part of something. And as a matter of fact, he describes clubs, work groups, religious groups, family, even things like gangs, all surround the human's need to be accepted, to belong, to feel appreciated, to feel loved. And my friends, I believe he is 100% correct. The human being has innately certain instincts, certain inborn desires, certain needs. One of those needs is a need to connect to other human beings in significant, rather powerful ways. Meaning beyond just family, beyond just brother, sister, mother, father, daughter, to connect to a bigger picture, to connect to a group. And that human need is something that Hashem implanted within the person. And the Rishiv explained, when he was explaining this Chazal, that Hashem created the Jew with a very real, innate, inborn sense of connection. There's a sense of unity, there's a sense of one body, I'm connected to the Jewish nation, and it's, the Rishiv said, that's so powerful, so innate to the human, that can work when you're in a fit of rage, when you're angry, when you're furious, when you're demanding revenge. You can focus on the fact that we're one body, we're one unit called the Klal Yisrael, there's one entity, and when you allow yourself to feel that which you intuitively know, that which you instinctively know, it calms down that need for revenge. You begin looking at it like the left hand stabbing the right. That's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. I would never do it. And that sense is real, overpowering, and can dramatically change the way we act and the way we think. The Chiddush is that it's inborn to the human, inborn to the Jew, the sense of belonging to a nation, the sense of being part of a people, the sense of connection. And it's something that is important to relate to, and important to remember, and is something that requires training. Okay, now, I'd like to share with you something that my daughter just explained to me today. PETA stands for People for Eating Tasty Animals. Now, that was a big Kiddush to me, because I didn't know that that's actually what it stood for. Now, I thought it stood for something a bit different, and I read, you know, some of PETA's propaganda. Now, when you're first exposed to PETA, you get the expression, you get the sort of sense that they're a little funny. You know, when they talk about friends don't eat friends, you know, they're these little furry critters, and they tell children, eat veggies, not friends. See, furry little friends are not for eating. Tell mommy not to feed you friends. You get the sense that they're a little wacky, and then you read some of this stuff, we're all part of the same family, there are brothers and sisters with equal rights, talking about sheep, cows, chickens, brothers, sisters, Pet ownership is absolutely abysmal situation, brought about by human manipulation. Chutzpah, you own a dog, how can you own a dog? It's like owning a slave, crazy. Then it gets even more. Everything we do lays a foundation for the one day when animals, all animals, will have rights. And when you read this stuff, you get the impression that they're a bunch of harmless kooks. A little bit, you know, funny. But people for the ethical treatment of animals are nothing to be concerned about. However, when you dig a little bit beneath the surface, you see they're not just some harebrained kooks. They're very, very focused. And when you see the comics that they put out, and you see the comic with a picture of a woman with an apron, blood spilled on it, a carving knife on it, chopping into a rabbit, and the words on the comic addressed to an 8-year-old is, tell your mommy not to kill. How many animals had to die for your mommy to wear that fur? you begin to realize that they're a bit nasty in their approach. Here's an expression, a quote from them: "We feel that animals have the same rights as retarded children." Okay? Here's one that, anyone Jewish in this audience? Here's one you may not so much appreciate. 6 million Jews died in concentration camps, but 6 billion broiler chickens will die this year in the slaughterhouse. That's by Ingrid Newkirk, president of PETA. Here's another one by her. "The leather sofa and handbag are the modern equivalent of the lampshades made from the skins of the people killed in the death camps." By the way, there's something called Holocaust on Your Plate. That's it's a college tour that PETA goes around the country explaining that this, you see that plate? You see that chicken? That and the Jews in Germany. You see, this is the Holocaust on your plate. "Humans have grown like a cancer with the biggest blight on the face of the planet." Okay, so you hear things and you realize they're not just kooks, they're also a bit nasty and they got a little bit of an edge to them. I'd like to share with you something that I recently read. The Chofetz Chaim was once speaking in Vilna, and he was asked to speak about any topic, and obviously what was closest to the Chofetz Chaim's heart was Lashon Hara. And he gets up and says, "We have to stop the slander, we have to stop the gossip, we must stop it. It's so evil, it's as bad," he says, "as eating chazer treif. It's like eating pork. Don't you understand that?" When the Chofetz Chaim was finished, Rav Chaim Ozer came over to the Chofetz Chaim and said, "You must get up and recant. You must tell the people that what you said was an error and that you don't hold by it." Chofetz Chaim said, "Why?" Explained Rav Chaim Ozer, "What they're going to hear is not that Lashon Hara is as forbidden as Chazer. They're going to hear that eating pig is only as bad as speaking Lashon Hara. Gaspa, these kind of things, slander is not really forbidden. It's, you know, you shouldn't. It's probably not so good, not so nice, not something we probably should do, but it's not forbidden. And what they're going to hear is the same way Lashon Hara is not forbidden. They're going to hear from your message that pork is not forbidden." And in fact, the Chofetz Chaim got up and recanted his statement in Vilna. And my friends, there is a major lesson to learn from that. If you'd like to know what the danger of PETA is, it's not when they put out comic books, it's when the issues of real decisions, of real priorities come to the fore. When there are issues of, do we save a dog or do we save a boy, and PETA proclaims that there is no moral basis to make that decision. Helping animals is not any more or less important than helping human beings. There is no rational basis in maintaining a moral distinction between the treatment of humans and other animals. And if you think they're kidding, the great bioethicist Peter Singer, who is recognized as their brilliant thinker, says as follows: "Babies up to 28 days after they are born may be killed, if in fact that killing them will be merciful." And these are his words: "Killing a disabled infant is not morally equivalent to killing a person. Often it is not wrong at all. A rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy," is Ingrid Newkirk's expression. And I'll explain to you what it means in plain, simple language. This is Michael Fox. The Humane Society of the United States said the following: "The life of an ant," now these are his words, "the life of an ant and that of my child should be granted equal consideration." Let me say it again. "The life of an ant and the life of my child," he's talking about his kid, "should be granted equal consideration." He's not only not embarrassed to say this, it's in writing, it's on the website, says it publicly. Here's one more, an organization called Last Chance for Animals. "Save the animals, I save the poor animals. If the death of one rat cured all diseases, it wouldn't make any difference to me. I wouldn't permit it." If the death of one rat, would it cure all diseases, mankind's all it does not permit killing that rat. Now, when you see this, you recognize that these people are rather strange in their philosophies. They're so far off that you have to say to yourself, what's pshat? How could anybody look at an ant, look at a human baby, and say they're equal? How could you possibly justify the two? And my friends, I'd like to share with you how you could view the two as equal. Let's assume for a moment that there was once upon a time a lucky roll of the cosmic dice. There was a big bang. Big, 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 big bang. So big that from this big bang spewed out 100 billion galaxies. Each galaxy containing 100 billion stars, each as powerful as our own sun. In those galaxies and stars, there are planets spinning around. And lo and behold, luckily, on one of these out of the 100 billion planets, there is a planet Earth, and an amoeba somehow miraculously forms. How the laws of physics began, how electricity began, how all the properties, I don't know, but don't bother me with the issues of matter and energy. Those are constants, those are givens. But on this Earth, suddenly, somehow, an amoeba formed. From that amoeba, life began level after level. And after a long chain of events, there was certain simple life began forming, more complex life. Eventually, you got the monkey. After the monkey came the man. And then you see the continuum, the ant, the man, and you recognize, in fact, there's not much difference. But a little step on the evolutionary ladder, and one more advance, the monkey, the man, the bird, the donkey, the cow, all occupants of the same planet, brothers and sisters, one has no precedence over the other, one surely should have no dominance over the other, and they're all equal. But my friends, this is the scary point. They are correct. If there is no God, if there is no creator, then the basis of their thought is solid, accurate, and correct. There is no valid distinction between an ant and a human baby if it's just a matter of evolving a more complex life form. Who's to say, because you're human, your life is any more precious, any more valuable than that of a cat, than that of a dog, than that of a broiler chicken? And in fact, if there is no creator, they're right. Unfortunately for them, they're wrong. Unfortunately for us, they are very, very wrong. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us very graphically and very clearly why is it that Adam was created last. The reason is because Hashem said, "You are the guest." And Hashem created an entire world. Hashem invited the guest called man and he laid the table. Before you invite the guest, you lay out the tablecloth and the fancy china. You bring out all the delicacies. And when everything is fully ready, ready to go, you bring in your guest. Says the Gemara, that's how Hashem created the entire world. Everything in it, because everything that was created from man. If you would like to understand the concept called Tsar Bali Chaim, not to cause pain to an animal, the Sefer Chinuch is very clear. He says it has nothing to do with the animal. It has everything to do with you. You see, if you act cruelly to an animal, you're going to imbibe that midah, that character trait within you. You are the problem. It's not about the animal. It's not about the chicken. It's not about the dog. It's not about the laboratory rat. It's about you. If you're going to pull the wings off of bats, you're going to train yourself in cruelty. You're going to ruin your character traits. You're going to affect your midos. Therefore, the Torah gives us various halachas, including Tsar Bale Chaim. And I believe, my friends, that that is exactly the answer to the Das Zakenim. There is nothing wrong with wearing leather shoes, leather belt, eating a delicious steak dinner, other than maybe your cholesterol. But there is nothing morally or ethically wrong with it. Still, all that being said, the Torah tells us, do shechit in a very particular way. Make sure you find the quickest, most humane, painless manner to slaughter the animal. Why? Because if you're going to act in a manner of cruelty, it's not so much the animal's going to suffer, you're going to suffer. If you're going to act cruelly, you're going to imbibe that midah, you're going to change yourself, you're going to train yourself in cruelty, find the most humane, quickest way to end that animal's life without pain. Shechita, exactly as set by the Gemara, is that way. And that's exactly what the Das Zakenim is saying. When you have a cow and you have a donkey, don't put them together. Why are we so concerned? The poor donkey, oh, Nebuchadnezzar, little Eeyore, you're going to suffer. We're not concerned for the donkey. It's a beast of burden. We're concerned for man. If you're going to put those two animals together, you're going to be turning a deaf ear to the pain of that animal. And what's going to happen is you're going to suffer. because you're going to imbibe cruelty, you're going to become achzar, because on some level the donkey does have pain. On some level the donkey hears the ox eating, it feels that it's being deprived. On some level there's pain. If you're going to be involved in that, you're training yourself in cruelty, you're training yourself in the type of midah that will become a part of you, and therefore the Torah says don't do this. But my friends, this concept is very, very big. Even though it may sound simple, it is something that requires repeating, because many from people miss this. There is nothing wrong with vegetarianism if you don't like meat. If chicken is something that, ugh, I just don't like it, be a vegetarian 100%. If you are a vegetarian because you feel it's a higher sense of morality, it's a better way to act, you'll excuse my saying it, then you're krum. I hate to use that strong of an expression, because you're being more religious than the Torah. You're being more moral than God, and you're creating a man-based morality. God, who created the heavens and the earth, the cosmos and all that it contains, said everything on this planet is for man. Chickens, eggs, fish, bison, it's all for man's use. As beasts of burden, as food for his dinner plate, Hashem says, I made it and that's the reason I made it. And if you feel you're more ethical, you're more moral than God, then you're going to find yourself with your man-based morality, and it won't be long before you're killing human babies, born or unborn, and you find that all of the pita proponents are rather interesting eco-terrorists. They have no trouble taking a can of red paint and splashing it on a woman's fur coat. Killed an animal! You killed an animal for that! They'll splash. They have no problem spilling acid on a scientist's face, blinding him because he experimented on rats. What he was doing was for the good of mankind, but in their sense of morality, he's a murderer, so they blinded him. And they have no problems beating to death various scientists and various peoples. And Ingrid Newkirk herself said the words, I would take it match to every lab in the world that uses animals if I could. Unfortunately, I don't have the guts. That corrupt, krum morality is based on man's version of morality. When Hashem created the world, Hashem said, there is a purpose for everything. All of it centers around man. All of it was created for the human. Use the world appropriately. Watch yourself. Don't abuse the world. Use animals as you should. Be careful with them, not because they're so significant, but because you are. And if you act in a cruel manner to an animal, you're going to teach yourself cruelty. You're going to damage yourself. And that's the whole concept of Tsar Bal Chayim. And at the risk of being a bit lengthy on this point, I think it bears understanding because it's much misunderstood in our generation. Okay, now, I'd like to share with you how one adopts hatred, baseless hatred. How do you learn to hate somebody for no good cause? It's not so simple, by the way. I'd like to share with you sort of the pathology of baseless hatred. Here's how it starts. Step number one, you have to notice that someone is different. You see, if we're all the same, let's say we're all of one nation, one people, so we're all brothers, all sisters, one am. The first thing I have to do is see that you're different. Whether it be the type of yarmulke you wear, the type of clothing you wear, the way you speak, how you speak, I have to find something different. Now, initially, all I noticed is that you speak with a Hasidish accent. You wear a kippah suga. You wear a sports jacket on Shabbos. Different. That's all I noticed. Different. Stage one. Stage two, I have to play judge and jury and say, you know, the kippah suga, nah, not good. Really wrong. It's just not right. You know, that big beard, too frum. Very, very, very frum. An accent? I don't like a Hasidic garb. Nah, it's wrong. Stage one is to notice a difference. Stage two is to paskin that it's wrong. But at that stage, you will never ever come to baseless hatred. You will not come to sinas chinam if it stops there. there's a third stage that's essential for any sort of sinas chinam. And that third stage is, I have to make you into an object. You are fafrumt. You're a chinyok. You're a bal tshuva. You're a whatever it is. I have to create you into an object. Once I've done that, now it's very simple. You see, if you're a human being, it's very hard for me to hate you. Because it's a human being, created in the tselem of Hashem. My people, how could I hate him? How could I say things like that? But the minute I could take you and make you into an object, aha, yishmak, now it's very, very easy, and it's very, very fun. You're a Mizrachinik. Chassidish, a creep. You're fafrumt. You're a, you're bal tshuva. Bukharian. Oh, you're regular. Regular FFB, no. That's goofa. An FFB, I don't like you either. You see, once I can make you into a group, into an object, now it's very easy. You could dislike a chair, you could dislike a shtender, you could dislike an object. And you see, my friends, this is a very big step. Because that ultimately is one of the great mistakes that we humans fall prey to. Because the minute you label someone, the minute you notice the difference, then play judge and jury in deciding that they're wrong, then do the third step called making them into the object, the global group called, whatever that global group is, right then you're in very real risk and very real danger of sinas chinam. And the reason I share that with you is because I think that this concept is something that's very, very natural, unfortunately, when we're living in large communities. You see, if there are 20 Jews, you're all together in one small group. If there are 200 or 2,000 or 200,000, automatically this starts becoming splinter groups, start becoming divisive little parts, and people start getting into these various little cliques, groups, associations, and before you know it, I'm not dealing with a human being. I'm not dealing with flesh and blood, I'm dealing with groups, I'm dealing with objects, and there's a very real difference in the way I treat other people. Now, I want to take one little step here, and I'll share with you an interesting story. When I came to yeshiva, I had a strong background in martial arts, and the little that I know how to learn, the yeshiva credited to my karate background. The yeshiva felt that the discipline that I learned in karate helped me tremendously in learning. And the yeshiva was a big, big fan of karate, of my staying involved in it, my keeping training in it, and even teaching it when I was in yeshiva, and even when I was in kollel, I was teaching. Until one day. One day I was speaking to the yeshiva about, somehow the topic came up about teaching, and I sort of described what happens in a typical karate class. And the yeshiva said, stop it, don't ever do it again. It's damaging. And the reason why was because I described something to the yeshiva that was very frightening to him. And that was, when you teach karate, you're trying to not just teach maneuvers, but you're teaching a mental attitude, you're teaching a mental toughness. And to do that, part of the job of the teacher is to toughen up the students. And by doing that, what you do is you stand over the students and you demand respect, command respect, and you do it now because I said so, and there's an instant recognition of a relationship of power, a relationship of obedience, and that's a big part of a successful karate student, because learning to be disciplined means learning to act in a particular manner, in a particular way. And when I described that to the yeshiva said to me these words, you're going to ruin your midos, don't do it. And the reason is, because while it may be effective in teaching martial arts, it's a very damaging thing. And the reason why it's damaging is because the reality is, what we practice, we become. And if you act in that manner, if you act in a manner of being cruel, tough, indifferent, if you act in a manner of being very, very dogmatic, what's going to happen, whether you mean it for the worst intentions or even for the best intentions, it's going to change who you are and going to affect you in a very real way. I'd like to share with you something that I find very interesting. It's a joke, but it has some value. An aboriginal cannibal was once watching a doctor performing surgery. And he watched the doctor take out a scalpel and began amputating a man's leg. And as the doctor is about to cut off the man's leg, the cannibal says, "Oh yeah, you're my kind of guy. Oh yeah, I relate to you." And here's the point. When a surgeon cuts off a leg of another human being, what is he doing? Well, it really depends on what his intentions are. If he's a cannibal, what he's doing is devouring a human being. If he's a skilled surgeon, he's doing a great act of mercy and of kindness. But it totally depends on his kavana, on his intention. And the reason I say that is because if we become that which we practice, your intentions make a big difference in who you will be. If you are in the medical field, you could be someone who is poking and prodding, or somebody who's helping and caring. And the difference is huge. Whether you're curing someone or cutting someone is totally based on your attitude. And what that means is, if you ever hear people get callous and they say, "Oh, there's the gallbladder in room 304. Oh, another one of those old people I got to deal with again." What they're doing is very frightening. It's not just that they're treating the reason for creation with disdain. It's not just that treating a human being without respect. What they're doing is their entire daily occupation is becoming barbarism, is becoming something that's training them in cruelty, because what they're now doing is not a health practitioner, but what they're doing is just by rote, just mechanical, just maybe even damaging. And that, my friends, is not a small point. If you don't hear it by healthcare, here's a classic example. Let's say you're a salesman. The job of a salesman is to convince somebody. But you see, the job of a salesman can be to be a sly, cunning, devious individual, or the job of a salesman could be to be helpful, to see what does my customer need, what's in their best interest. People have difficulty making decisions. Let me analyze what's best for this person, and let me help them with that process. But you see, the difference between those two is not necessarily how much money you'll make, but the difference between those two is whether you spend your entire day as a gnavisha, cunning, devious, deceitful person who's destroying his inner makeup, or you spend your day as a helpful human being who's benefiting others, and you become a much greater person. You see, who you are is dramatically affected by what you do. The Sefer HaChinuch explains to us why we have so many mitzvahs. He says the reason is because we're shaped, we're molded by what we do. And if all day long you're doing kindly giving acts, you become a kindly giving person. If all day long you're in it for me and me only, and I don't care about anybody else but me, then all day long what you're doing is you're training yourself in deceitfulness, nastiness, cruelty, and you're destroying the essence of who you are. And if you'd like to know what I mean, the next time, 2 a.m., your child wakes you up, and you hear the third time that night, "Wah, wah, stupid brat. Oh man, I gotta get out of bed for this kid. What is this kid, colicky baby?" Ooh. That is a natural reaction. But I want you to hear well what I'm saying. If when you get out of bed, your reaction is, "Drat, that bratty, nasty, colicky kid, I gotta get out for him." What you're doing is, even though you're getting out of bed, and even though you're acting in a way of a generous person, what you're doing is you're destroying your midos. What you're doing is you've decided that this other thing is a bother, and nebuch, you have to do it because you have a responsibility, and you're not gaining one of the great accomplishments that a human being can. Let me flip it around for a minute. Imagine someone, same scenario, gets out of bed and says, "This is a responsibility that Hashem gave me. There's a human being who's in pain there. There's a human being that I can help." And that person gets up and gives that baby the bottle. Same action, but worlds of difference in terms of who they are. It's a chesed or it's a drat. And that difference is a very, very huge difference. And once a person begins understanding this, then you begin understanding that one of the greatest opportunities to mold yourself into a different human being is this opportunity called being a parent. Because as a parent, you get this golden chance to do something for someone else without any interest for me. But you see, that's not so simple. And when a mother gets up and gives and gives and gives, it's great. It's wonderful. And women are maternal. And you say, that's amazing. Look what she's doing. She's training herself in chesed. She's training herself in giving kindliness. Until you recognize that it's her kid. It's my child. My kid. And it's just an extension of me. And you recognize, while it's good, while it's something, and it's some element of it is selfish. And if a person wants to reach the ultimate level for which we were created, that's to learn to be other-centered, to help this child because this child is in need, and my child or someone else's child, I have to help them, I have to do, because Hashem wants me to be giving and kindly and generous. And then what you're doing in the various activities of your day is molding yourself into a vastly different human being. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from this Das Kanim. If you find an animal that's in pain, a human being has to feel the pain. Not because the animal has pain, not because the animal is significant. The animal is not significant. You could eat that animal for dinner and there's nothing wrong with it. But if you sit by and watch an animal in pain, you're training yourself in cruelty. If you take your donkey and your ox and you put them together and you know the donkey is going to have some, not major pain, but some pain, you're training yourself on some level in cruelty. And the Torah says, don't do it, it's a philosophy, because the Torah is so sensitive, not to the animal's pain, to the damage done to me. Because the human being is very, very sensitive. When you shecht an animal, it has to be very quick, in the most humane manner, because that is what the Torah wants for me to become more sensitive. Freud, Skinner had a very different view of the human. What Maslow came along and said was that there are needs within the human being. One of the great needs for the human being has is a need to belong, a need for connection, a need to feel a part of something, and that's exactly what the Yerushalmi says. When the Gemara Yerushalmi says, I'm going to give you an eitzah, I'll give you advice. You want to learn how not to take revenge? Imagine your left hand cutting and it stabs the right. Your right hand won't stab back. You know why not? Because you're one body. The Gemara is giving a practical example, something you could use. How could you use it? The answer is because there's an inborn sense within the Jew. We're one unit. We're one Am. We're one nation. We're but just different limbs of the same body. But that's something we can feel, something we can identify with, if, and this is a big if I train myself to feel it. You see, I have two parts to me. I can become very cruel, very self-centered, very selfish, or I can feel that innate sense of belonging, that innate sense of feeling somebody else's pain. Either one is doable, and it's up to me how I use my time, how I use my situations, what I do with my activities that will shape me. Pita has a very, very corrupt version of the world. Their inverse understanding of the world is based on one simple mistake. And that simple mistake is that everything just is, all evolved, and therefore there is no sanctity to life. The Das Torah perspective on it is there's a huge, huge difference between a human baby and any primate. That difference is that one was created in the image of God, one is holy, one's life is so valuable that Hashem says, I would have created the heavens and the earth and all that it contained for that baby alone. Not for all the monkeys in the Amazon, not for all the donkeys in the Sahara Desert. For one human baby. And that understanding is something that we have to train ourselves in. But ultimately, the great chiddush is that I am very, very susceptible to change. I'm very, very malleable, very moldable. The way I act, the way I go through my day changes me. But the point is, my day is basically what my day is. Whether I'm in business, whether I'm a salesman, whether I'm a teacher, whether I'm a nurse, whether I'm an occupational therapist, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. But how I do it makes such a difference. That same surgeon could be a life giver or just a money-hungry, grubbing, scalping, cutting person. And that difference is huge, not so much in the money that he makes, and maybe not even in the type of operation that he performs, but in who he is for eternity, and understanding that I am very, very much dependent. Who I am is completely dependent on how I use my actions, how I use my life situations, helps me understand things and relate to things in a vastly different way. I'd like to close with something that I think is very, very powerful and encapsulates these concepts. Tiferes Shlomo brings down something. It is rare that you'll hear a Hasidisha vort from me, but this I cannot resist, and I cannot help but say this. Rav David Lozhava was a great Ohev Yisrael. He was a Hasidisha Rebbe, and he was known throughout the world as a tremendous Ohev Yisrael. He got a reputation of being one of the great tzaddikim of the generation, and he got a reputation of being a real lover of fellow man, a real lover of Jews. In a letter, he wrote the following words. He says, "How can you say about me that I am the tzaddik of the generation? How could you call me an Ohev Yisrael when I still love my own children more than I love other people? I'm nowhere near Mordechai, because by Mordechai at Tzadik, it says he was Godle Hudim Rotzilor of Echav, Dorish Tov Li Amo, he desired good for his entire nation. To Mordechai there was no difference, his own flesh, not his own flesh, any member of the Klai Yisrael were one to him, he was Dorish Tov La Amo, I'm nowhere near what Mordechai is, don't call me a true Ohev Yisrael." And when I read these words, I said, wow, that man has a vastly different perspective than we do. He felt it was a taina against him that he loved his children more than he loved other people. That's instinct, that's natural. Until you understand that it's also instinctive and also natural to have a sense of bonding, a sense of unity, a sense of love with my nation, then it's instinctive and natural to allow those feelings to expand, and the ultimate tzaddik is that person who can feel it. That madriga is not for you and I, but certainly being aware of it, being aware that the concept is supposed to spread from my children to others, to feel a bond, to feel a connection, but at the end of the day it only happens if I work on feeling it, work on using the emotions, work on using the various situations. May Hashem grant us wisdom, understanding, and ability to put this into practice.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Tiferes B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozin free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.